Blog Talk Radio.
Because we want to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim. This is the 195th class in search of ancient, authentic Torah, class number 47. We continue with our next humble effort, blessings, right now exploring Genesis chapter 2, verse 16. And the Lord God commanded the men, saying, of every tree of the garden thou shalt mayest freely eat. Well, that's an old type of English. Note, blessed souls, that this is the first time the word commandment is mentioned in the Torah or Bible. So that which is obviously mentioned in the verbal mix, why do so many blessed souls get bent out of shape by the very word commandment? As well, we hope to vibe out on Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, Maimonides, Chabad slash or plus Breslov Chassidus, from the works, The Path of the Righteous Gentile, Rabbi Rogalski and Rabbi Chaim Klorfim, Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition, by Rabbi David Sears, plus, and you know, you will not be surprised, blessed souls, when something comes down the pipeline of live radio, some surprises, which are part and parcel of the human family experience. I'd like to bring on now our co-host, teacher, and student, disseminator, activist, and advocate of the teachings of Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Don. Good morning to our listeners.
Yes. Now, Dennis, I have a couple things I want to share with everyone before we get into what we call the meat of the program. And that's this, that this program, Soul Class, let's remember, blessed souls, that Soul is an acronym for S70, oldest or original, U, universal laws, the 7 9 commandments, Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, And we're not going to delineate them, but rather we ask people to do their own research into the matter, so to speak, to do homework before listening to our next class. And then you can call in and ask us. Not necessarily we're going to provide the answers, but we can do further research to keep the dialogue running. This is about a running dialogue. This is not one show being the truth of all truths. It's about an exploration into human consciousness, which we try to project through our humble efforts, just like it is understood from the teachings of Chabad Chassidus, that a human being does not remain in a state of consciousness which we would call static, in regard to both his or her inner and outer experiences, meaning people can fluctuate in their consciousness. And it makes sense, we also see too, in the material matters that a person experiences in his or her life. Sometimes we're up with our material matters, sometimes we're down with our material matters. Sometimes a person can attain wealth and honor and achieving success in his or her endeavors, and other times it can be the reverse, God forbid. And certain areas a person can be successful in, it could be in raising the children, it could be in relationships with other people, and certain areas they struggle. We also see, blessed souls, that we regular people, and I categorize those of us who are putting forth our humble efforts and those who are listening, we're in the category of the large masses of people who need to be instructed by the righteous, but by the righteous themselves, as King Solomon teaches us in Proverbs 24:16, a tzaddik, a righteous person, will fall 7 times and rise, meaning even for the most righteous in the creation, and you can come up with your own examples for yourselves, bless those, who is righteous historically, who is righteous in the recent past, or who you may know to be a righteous person right now, there is a point where each person at the state of righteousness will ascend and descend and be in a middle ground. As well, we see too, we can see that with people, they can be sometimes in a state of joy and gladness of heart and expansive mind consciousness, and therefore when they start to pray, if their mind was in a state of expansion, their prayer can be with joy and can be with gladness of heart. They can be moved with excitement from a depth from within their heart, and they can be doing meditating on a level that is really, really an expansive state of consciousness. And other times a person can wake up in the morning with a broken heart and feeling low and singing the blues and feeling a sense of being humbled for no apparent reason at all. You see, blessed souls, it's not about just because you want to connect to God, you're guaranteed a freebie type of life, free of cares and strifes. There's the ups and downs of life. But if you are centered in your simple faith in the Creator, you're able to deal with all the vacillations, all the changes in life, and that's what makes life the rich experience it is. I mean, for example, if a person gets their favorite chocolate, let's say you have your favorite chocolate bar and you eat it, you have another chocolate bar. Well, after your third or fourth chocolate bar, that sweet chocolate you craved or desired will become very bitter tasting. So, springing off of what I had to say, I'd like Dennis to make any comments, questions, or concerns about our introduction.
That's a broad introduction, Don. We come in all sizes, shapes, colors, forms, you name it. Humans cannot be put into a cookie cutter because our behavior sets us off differently from other people. We can change, we can modify, we can go back to what we were in the beginning, but we always have a chance to come back to the righteous path, to the Lord. There's nothing holding anybody back. You may waver, but you can always come back. And that's a unique thing regarding our religious beliefs in the Almighty, that He is there for us. It doesn't matter where you've been, where you're going. But if you want to come back or you want to be on the correct track, the Lord has His arms open for you. And we must tell people that they should realize this, that there was a song that said, you have a friend in God, or they used the term Jesus at the time for the song, but everybody has a friend in God. And if you don't treat him as a friend, then you're at a loss. That's your fault. Your conscience should direct you in the right direction.
Yes, thank you, Dennis. Dennis, excuse me, I'm choking, I think, on something that I had, what I'm currently drinking. I juiced up some broccoli with some grapes and some flaxseed, and it has a gelatinous type of taste, so I coughed. Please excuse me. I would like to share a poem, Dennis, and bless it's all any of you out there listening. And again, you can call in if you want to vibe out with us at 347-838-8669. This morning I got an email through Facebook through a Bas Noach, a faithful daughter of Noah. Her name is Teresa Lynn Wyatt. And she submitted to me a poem, and before that she had some trepidations of pasting it on my wall. And I looked at the poem and said, please, by all means, not only would I like you to post it on the wall, but I would like to read it now on the show, and then we'll bounce it off of Dennis and anyone, again, wants to call in. We also just got warm regards from Jerusalem, from Rabbi Eliezer Goldstock, who co-hosts a show with me on Tuesday mornings, Blessed Souls Calling, getting to the heart of the matter. And maybe he'll call in. We might have also Alfredo Yeshua from the wilds of Pennsylvania listening in. Hopefully he'll call in. Alfredo Yeshua, I hope you will call in. But this is a poem by Teresa Lynn Wyatt. And then we'll get some feedback from Dennis, what he thinks about it. And I'd like to give some feedback on it as well. So here it goes. Hear, O Israel, the deaf and dumb, agents bear witness of things to come. As sure as the moon and the stars above, Hashem will redeem you and call you beloved. The words are expelled, be silent and see. The Lord is one, there is no we. There's no new thing beneath the sun. How you would complete what hasn't begun. Divide and regroup within the wheel. It wasn't new then and isn't new still. Correction is coming to be patient. I'm sorry, correction is coming, be patient and wait. After the Sabbath, there's more to create. A creator at rest is bound to return, restoring the image that others have burned. Dennis, what's your feeling on that poem?
Feeling on that poem clearly accentuates the word future. In other words, what you're going through now is the test that we all are going through on the earth. But there's more. There's good things to come, and there is a positive future if you can look past the things that your eyes see right now. So we all place our faith in the Lord and the future that everything will come out right side up.
Beautiful. Thank you, Doug. Now, I'd just like to give some brief feedback on the poem. Teresa Lynn White, thank you again for that contribution. And anyone out there who's listening or any of my Facebook friends, if you'd like to write a poem, a brief little writing, I'd be happy to read it because I think it just broadens the dialogue, gives a little greater texture to the show. So maybe, Teresa, you had some trepidation that you mentioned here, is of the deaf and dumb. Yes, among our people, among the Jewish people, there are people who are spiritually deaf and dumb, and unfortunately there are people physically deaf and dumb. And as well, among the nations, there are people who are spiritually deaf and dumb, which meaning they're not hearing the word, and they're not speaking the word dumb, meaning mute, as I understand it. And the thing is, though, it's not just that we will be redeemed and we will be loved. Everyone is beloved, because the teaching in Pirkei Avos by Rabbi Akiva, who was a righteous convert, whose great-great-great-grandfather was actually Sisera, was a Canaanite general who was defeated. And so, therefore, anyone can come into the Word of the Most High to transmit consciousness of that very fact that there is one Creator and there is no just one we to the exclusion of another we. And in fact, we see from chapter 12, verse 3 in Genesis that there are blessings offered for those who bless the seed of Abraham. But the good news is not we can bless the seed of Abraham, the nations of the world, but it says those that will bless you, the Creator says, I will bless. So that's what the challenge we set out to the world for those people who want to work with Israel, dialogue with Israel. If you bless us, yes, we'll bless you, but the good news is something greater than us will bless you, and that's the Creator. That being said, I'd like to discuss very briefly, I didn't talk about this with Dennis before the show, but I'd like to get his reaction to it. The fact that this past week, there was a gathering at the MetLife Stadium here in the Meadowlands in New Jersey, where about 92,000 Yehudim, Jews, got together, the Anahara without the bad eye upon them. To celebrate the completion of the learning of the Babylonian Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud is about 2,700 pages plus or minus, and each page has two sides. It's about 5,400 pages. And as I heard one commentator say, that the Babylonian Talmud is actually more pages than President Obama's new health care plan. So it's quite involved, and it covers all topics. But what I'm not here to promote Talmudic learning to anyone, blessed souls, although it's a nice thing to learn, and anyone can learn it if they want to understand who the nation of Israel is in terms of getting our tradition. The point is that 92,000 Jews came together, not for a political event, not to promote a movie, not to promote an ideology, say like the state of Israel is a fulfillment of prophecy, which I do not believe it is a fulfillment of prophecy based on the teachings of Rambam, which the Lubavitch Rebbe said. Rather, it was just a, so to speak, a present after the massive hemorrhaging that we suffered during the Holocaust. But the fact that it became publicly known to the world that Jews get together to learn Torah, and if we're getting together to learn Torah, we want to encourage everyone else that it doesn't matter what religion you are, it doesn't believe what your theology is. The scripture is a universal teaching which encompasses Christianity and Islam, and also in the more spiritual aspects of the Torah, different types of meditations which have seeped into Hinduism and even Buddha. Dennis, any thoughts, concerns about, or ideas, agreeing or disagreeing, that it's a good thing that Jews should be identified in a massive group of learners of Torah? Hopefully that will encourage other people to learn Torah, the Bible, the Scripture.
Well, to me, it's about time some Jewish people decided to come out in public and make a statement. We haven't had this happen in such a long time because I don't know why. If you believe that you have the truth in your hands, in your heart, in your mind, well, why not go public? Why keep it to yourselves? So I don't understand this, but maybe the world is changing, and we hope for the better, because the Jewish people in the Holy Land were the center of all religious belief way back when. Not all religious, but of the area and of the known Western world at the time. But there's nothing wrong with going public. It shows that you're not afraid and you're willing to share. But it doesn't matter if it's Talmudic or not. All learning is good, and all learning benefits mankind. But to have people come out and say, we strongly believe in this, we strongly believe in that, is not a bad thing, because we have a lot of people who are going around and doing this politically for anti-religious reasons in many cases. And they are getting more media and more political attention than the people who are on the righteous path. So this bothers me when people are silent when they should know. So I feel good that when people come out together and feel like they have to share in a common goal or a future thing that they're hoping for, or they're sharing their views. There's nothing wrong with that. You can accept it or reject it. But if these are good people, then what is there to reject in the sense of their objective? So we all have a little piece and a little part of this. So yes, Don, I was happy to hear that people coming out in public for pro-God ideas.
Thank you, Dennis. And also I want to bring out two more points, Dennis. Number one, there was discussion, maybe you've heard of Brian Lehrer. He's a radio show, radio host in New York City on WNYC, I think it's called. And it's interesting, I ride my bike every day to work, and I tune into that. I want to hear what's going on in the world. I listen to all the different radio stations. I listen to WBAI, I listen to 1010 Winds, I listen to News 88, I listen to the conservative talkers, I speak to them. I like to listen to everyone. I don't want to take just one person's view to get an idea of the spectrum of human consciousness as at least it comes over the radio. And Brian Lehrer brought up a discussion, which I want to clarify. According to the position of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the question of is that can women learn Talmud? Now, there is a Talmudic teaching that said that they should not be learning these more in-depth type of Talmudic reasonings for the sake that they will gain a certain cunning, and that type of cunning could be used for mischievous activities, which we're not going to elaborate upon. However, I spoke with a rabbi last night, and I heard about this before previously, that it was around 1977 where the Belzer Rebbe had met, he's a Rebbe in the land of Israel, had met with an audience with the Rebbe, which apparently this audience had been recorded. Sometimes the Rebbe would have private audiences of people, sometimes he would have public audiences, and their conversations were recorded for posterity. And the Belzer Rebbe was complaining that he didn't like the idea that there was an idea being promoted that women were learning Talmud. And the Rebbe stiffly rebuked that type of idea. Basically, to paraphrase, he said, if you don't want the women to use their minds for learning Talmudic study, then they're going to wind up looking at the fashion magazines. And I'm sorry, I don't think by looking at fashion magazines, although I'm not going to say we should ban them, I don't think women looking at fashion magazines are going to make them that much better in terms of their piety or their belief in God, but rather they'll be learning a certain type of cunning in order to, unfortunately, engage in mischievous behavior, which, listen, certain types of behavior are permitted. We're talking about, of course, sexual behaviors. But to me, sexual behavior, Dennis, and those out listening, is like the money you make. You don't go into the street and tell people what you make. Only a fool would do that. So to broadcast oneself, sexually speaking to me, is akin to telling people what type of salary you're drawing in. And no one likes to do that because when you make that type of pronouncement in the street, whether it be your the amount of money you make or what your assets are, or do you own your house, do you rent your house, you're inviting others to play with you and possibly hurt you. Dennis, any thoughts on these matters?
Yes, and this agitates me a little bit, Don, because it almost borders on the nonsense. Why? Because God created Adam and Eve. He didn't create Adam and the other person. It was Adam and Eve. They were equals almost. So therefore, you cannot come out and say learning will cause a backlash that people will use it against the good. Learning is positive. Why would you think that if you teach somebody about God that they will use it against you or other people? That's nonsense. There is no fear and mistrust there. When God created Adam and Eve, he created two people. And that's how humanity began. Mm-hmm. He honored that. We cannot all of a sudden say, wait a minute, we have different levels of different human beings here because we're afraid or we fear or there's mistrust. No. We must love everybody.
Dennis, thank you very much. I don't mean to be rude, but we actually have a special caller and someone I'm so happy that you'll be able to interact with. This is Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Goldstock, who was founder and director of Heart to Heart, an organization for the past 21-plus years, has been dedicated to educating the Jewish community and the greater human family experience community that if a parents give birth to a special needs child or distinguished child, and the specialty Rabbi Goldstock and his wife, Chana Tova, for 21-plus years, are world experts on how to deal with children who have Down syndrome, which equals Up syndrome. Eliezer, thank you to the show, and we have online Dennis Ryan. So thank you for coming in. I know your time is very valuable. Thank you for chiming in.
Ufa Ratzta Yama Vekedma Tzafayna Venegma. I can't tell you how wonderful it is to be sitting here in Jerusalem listening to you guys and very much enjoying the discussion.
So Eliezer, I'd like to formally introduce you to Dennis Ryan. Dennis is a teacher.
Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how you doing?
Baruch Hashem.
Boka Tov.
So Arayim Tov. It's Boker by you and afternoon by us. So it's a beautiful day.
Eliezer.
We're encompassing the whole thing.
Eliezer, what is your take?
I just wanted to throw in a comment, if I could.
Yes. Yes.
You know, we as Jews are, male and female. And as you mentioned, you know, nobody would be foolish enough to run out and say how much money they're making or what their private lives are like. But the truth of the matter is we are like a kaleidoscope. You remember those things that you used to look in and, you know, you twist it around and you put it up to the light, and all these different patterns would form. And you never got the same two, you know, formed quite the same. And I once took one of these things apart, and you know what it was? It's a bunch of colored rocks. So I realized that, you know, if you could create such a beautiful vision through turning a cardboard, viewing window on top of another, and use light and rocks to create such a dynamic. Can you imagine what it's like to, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is taking all the Jewish people and, you know, all of the neshamas and twisting this thing around and looking at it. What an amazing, amazing kaleidoscope we must produce. What a vision we must be. And as far as studying and learning and reading magazines and, you know, the profanity of, you know, the magazine, the bottom line is we live in a world that is constantly pulling us to the profane. And it's been that way since day one. It's just getting more intense today. And with the increase in the intensity of this profane, to say to somebody not to study something, to me, I don't know. I you know, God forbid, I'm not going to go against any Rebbe like that. But I do remember that there was a Rebbe once who told me openly that the reason that he continues to tell people to give children away that are born with Down syndrome and other disabilities is because that's what he always did and that's what his father did. And to go against that would be like going against his father and going against what he's already told people in the past. Let me finish. I'll be right with you. So the bottom line is that if a Rebbe is going to get stuck in that milieu of thinking and direct his thought to, well, how is it going to look to the one that I already told the last time, then we're never going to see change like that. And as far as the magazines that you're referring to, I think that, you know, it has to do more with the upbringing of the person themselves versus the magazines. The magazines are secondary because one girl can look in the magazine and see the most snussy looking things, the most unsneistic things. And another woman is looking in the magazine and she's looking specifically to find things that she can wear that are permitted, that would enhance her Torah beauty. So the issue really is not whether we can or can't learn. It's whether or not the Rebbes that have come before us and the Rabbanim and those who understand what's happening today are willing to say, okay, look, what we've done in the past was good, just like the Rambam's medications, for example. They were all top-notch medications in their time. Today, the society has changed. We've grown. We've expanded. We've altered our growth and development has completely altered the future, the past to the future, in terms of who we are and what we are physically, mentally, spiritually. And now those medications that the Rambam was offering us are no longer as effective as they once were. And today, we have to be willing to say, look, what was working once before isn't working now. Let's change. And if you look at the development just in the women's movement itself today, and I'm talking about the full women, women are much more active in the community and much more participatory in terms of their interaction and dynamic in the firm community today than they ever were. You have organizations that are actually, providing opportunities for women to actually speak and to participate in creating a new direction. And I think women's input is so important and significant at this point in time because the women have a different value set. They have a different perspective than men do. know, man was first. Then came, you know, yes, we're equal because we all came from the same source and so forth. But man was there first, so he's, you know, supposed to make decisions, et cetera, et cetera. But the woman has really got a different value set, a different subset of values, different primary set of values. And that's what, wherein lies the secret, I think, to being allowing us to move into the future as Jews, completely prepared, properly prepared, to allow ourselves to interact and develop, you know, with the world at large, in a spiritually whole way.
Well, I think Eliezer, and I will let Dennis chime in, that I think that the nations of the world, because of, I think there was a tremendous outrage over the last 100-plus years. I mean, it used to be a woman, say, in America, couldn't vote. She didn't have, you know, there were issues going on. And the women's liberation movement, I think, in a sense, was a good thing, except for one thing, though. It placed the woman in a level where it kind of dehumanized her, because I think to take away from a woman's sense of nurture as the,
right.
You know, in like we've mentioned it many times with other people as well, that the people get turned off by the fact that women are sitting on the side of the congregation or in the back. Sometimes, some places they're even situated higher than the men in the pro services, because and they say, well, women are being made secondary. No, it's not. It's because men are inferior. And that we, given our more base nature, that if we're praying next to a woman who's swaying back and forwards, I mean, we have to be honest, we're going to be distracted from the one we're supposed to be praying to. If I'm praying to God, I'm not supposed to be distracted by the perfume of another woman. It's my
darn,
weakness.
Nothing yeah. distracts me. Nothing.
So with that being said, but I think that the women's liberation, say, like
yes,
in America, it
yeah.
took it dehumanized the women by saying, you know, there's so many women, I've heard stories and I've read, they're in their 40s, 50, well, actually 50, 60, 70 years older, they never had children because they felt they needed to be liberated. But being a wife and a caretaker is a experience of liberation to fully actualize oneself. And if one wants to go and have a career, hey, do it in a balanced way. So let's turn the mic, Eliezer, to Dennis on his take on all this stuff.
Well, what the doctor said is interesting, because it not only applies to Jews, but it applies to a lot of other human beings.
That's right.
And that is the world of distractions. If we're distracted so much, we get away from the path we should be on, we have to start heading back in some way, shape, or form. If it worked in the past, that doesn't mean it's not going to work in the future. So we must be open-minded and look for solutions that will help mankind. I think the doctor was correct. And the other thing is that you talked about the women's movement. What that in itself was another distraction, because it took away from total humanity and it placed it all on the woman. And that's why people were saying, well, we need more women to run these countries, so we're better. Who knows? But what happens, we're looking for an equal balance. And in the words of Maimonides, I would say moderation. Moderation works.
Thank you, Dennis.
You know, thanks, Dennis. That's very insightful, actually. I was thinking a little bit along the lines of kind of what Don was saying, too, was that, you know, it's funny because men, Judaism in general, puts women on a pedestal. Most people don't realize that. Don was saying, alluding to the fact that, you know, the women are on the other side of the mechitza, and, you know, it's denigrating and so forth. That's only that way because that's what everybody wants to see. It's not what's going on. It's what everybody wants to be going on. What we have going on and what's really happening in Yiddishkeit is that the Jewish people put women on a pedestal. Women are perfect. They come into the world, they don't need a bris milah, they don't need to have, 8 days goes by and they're still perfect, you know. 8 days goes by and, you know, the man is, the boy is just becoming perfected. And that's something that has to be done in this world. And it's an example of everything that happens in this world. All that happens in this world that is happening towards perfecting a person in a spiritual and a psychological and emotional and intellectual way is all happening to the man. The woman comes into the world already in a refined, perfected level. And therefore, Judaism puts the woman already up on a pedestal, and we revere her in such a way that men don't take it, and especially in Judaism, we don't take it lightly that we just, you know, go and do, let's, you know, greet into a social setting and we'll exchange greetings by shaking hands. Shaking hands is a very, carries with it a tremendous power. And so, therefore, only men shake hands with men. And I made an agreement with my wife that the day I married her, she would be the only woman whose hand I would shake. And that way, I won't come to make a mistake. And you know, you can't have a problem with another woman if you can't touch her hand to shake it. If you can't get beyond that point, you're pretty safe. And in the society at large, yeah, sure, people do all kinds of things. No question about it. We all make mistakes, everybody. But that's not to say that the rules and the guidelines aren't already there to prevent those things from happening. And the point is that if the woman is already perfect and if she's on a pedestal, then the only real purpose is that, look, again, it doesn't all work perfect. I understand this. In a perfect world, it would all work exactly the way it was intended to work. But we don't live in that world. We live in a world that is perfect, but we haven't perfected it yet, and we haven't perfected our ability to live in it. It's still a kaleidoscope. And as much as we agree or disagree with a lot of what's going on, just keep turning it, and eventually, you know, you start to get a pattern that you like, and the color starts to, and the hue becomes, you know, a pattern that, and a variety of colors and shapes that is attractive. And once you realize that there is an inner peace that can exist, between man and woman, and between woman and man, and between society and man, and society and woman, that it's just a matter of us coming to a point where we recognize where we really are now versus, as Dennis said, where we were and where we want to be.
Well, we have an old adage, a non-Jewish adage, believe it or not. I just relabeled it. And that is, the man is the head, but the woman is the heart.
Right, right. Man is the, right. Ma'ach shlita'a leiv, exactly. And that's exactly what the, but that doesn't, it doesn't mean that a man doesn't have a heart or a woman doesn't have a brain. That's what, you know, you see what you said was exactly true. But we have to add the part that says, we're using that as an example, the dogma of what is, in this world, and we're also using that as an example of what of a certain level on a certain level that's true. But when it comes to making decisions as to how the children are taught brachas or how the children are taught to prepare for meals, et cetera, it's the woman who's actually doing all that. Yes, the husband is quote unquote the head of the household, but he's not the head of the household if he's not there. And who is the head of the household when the husband isn't there? It's the wife. It's the woman.
That's right.
And who is the who's in charge of? And what if there's a, what if it's a home where, you know, chasuch home, chasuch leil olam, there is no husband in the house for whatever reason? Does that mean that the woman doesn't have the capacity to be the brains and the heart? No, of course not. But we're talking about in an ideal world, in a perfect scenario, what is it? We have to have that which we're shooting towards, and then we have to have that where is where we are, and then somewhere in the middle of that is really what we're trying to apply, because there's no way that we can apply the whole dynamic all at once every single time. It just doesn't work. But somehow knowing what the whole overall objective and purpose is in our lives, it allows us to make those compromises within the framework of where a compromise should be made.
Beautiful. Gentlemen, I'd like to move on to the next section, which I think is going to be a juicy section for Dennis and Rabbi Goldstock to engage in. As we have been accustomed for many, many classes, we are extracting out from a paper that was submitted to Dr. Richard Elmore at Harvard University by six individuals, some of the most, how should we say, these people are in the cusp of developing new educational systems in their particular parts of America. We're talking about Ami Abeta, Robert Garcia, Guadalupe Guerrero, Beth Cheviano Narvaez, Latoya Walker, my good prayer partner and friend, Shimon Warrenker, principal of PS770. This paper is called The New American Academy, New Model for Education, which Dr. Elmore had told Shimon this was the best paper ever submitted to him. This is a doctoral program. All of them have earned their master's degree, and hopefully in the future they'll get their PhD in education. So we're going to pull out from the paper, gentlemen, and blessed souls listening out there, the part where we've already started to learn about Horace Mann, who some would consider to be the father of American education at some level. He went to Prussia and different European countries to see how they were implementing a public school system, because public school systems at that time in the 19th century had been relegated to basically religious institutionalized systems. And Horace Mann thought that perhaps it could be an upgrade, not necessarily to wipe away the primarily Christian belief systems or education systems, but see that how other structures, other systems were being used to educate the masses in Europe, and perhaps they could be implemented in America. So we're going to read now the following two paragraphs. Here we see that Mann believed that he found in the Prussian practices admirable enough to quote-unquote copy. He sincerely believed that he could transplant the system without adopting the quote-unquote passive obedience to a monarchy or to a church. However, he believed that this passive obedience could be useful. As quoted from page 488, this was a paper, I think, written by Jonathan Nyberg in Jonathan Nyberg's Theory of Power, that he wrote the following. In the second place, if Russia can pervert the benign influence of education to the support of arbitrary power, we can surely employ them for the support and perpetuation of republican institutions. A national spirit of liberty can be cultivated more easily than a national spirit of bondage. And if it be made one of the great prerogatives of education to perform the unnatural and holy work of making slaves, then surely it must be one of the noblest instrumentalities for rearing a nation of freedom. If a moral power over the understandings and the infections of people may be turned to evil, may it not also be employed for the highest good? So there's a lot going on here, a lot of the thoughts, but the idea, I'd like Eliezer to comment, because you are a pioneer in integrating children with UP syndrome into a yeshiva system, having one of your students, David, recently graduating from the Flatbush Yeshiva. David, his last name again, please?
David Chimnell.
David Chimnell. So I'd like you,
J-E-M-A-L,
you know,
if
passive obedience and trying to unshackle people from an educational system, which is just making them more submissive and instead of being more open and more educated and more... Eliezer, what are your thoughts on this? I'm throwing a lot of things together. I gave you a kaleidoscope of commentary or questions.
Just as an example, you use Horace Mann as a point of reference. In the early years of, I think it was in the early 1900s, maybe even the late 1800s, the public school system was being developed in the United States, and they wanted to develop something that would be universal. In other words, everything should have a universal approach. So whoever was being educated in Wyoming would be getting basically the same approach in education. I'm not talking about quality because I don't know how that worked, as somebody in Florida or Maine. The point was that they wanted to develop something. So a group of scientists, for example, got together in New York, and they said, you know what? Let's just pick one way of doing it. So they picked, they said, what will we teach first? Oh, we'll teach biology first. Okay, and what will be next? Chemistry. Let's teach chemistry next. And what will be next? Physics. Okay, good. now we've got that. So they turned to the guy at the end of the table. I said, and why did you pick that order? And he says, well, alphabetical, of course. So it turns out that that's not actually, I mean, if Ross is listening, he'll plainly tell you that that's completely baloney, and it's not the proper way to go about developing a scientific, make a scientific development. Because, and it, by the way, it's not the way it's done in most countries of the world. It just happens to be done that way in America, and that's the way it was done before, and that's the way it's always been done, and that's the way it's going to always be done. So in answer to that question and the question before, which we were talking about, sometimes the way things are just becomes comfortable and easy. Now, if you look at the educational system in America today, most people that go through the public school system come out of it completely prepared to become good soldiers in the Army. Because that's what the public school system teaches. I mean, yeah, there's education going on there, but there's also some rote behavior and regimentation going on in the school systems as well. Everyone's sitting in a row. Everybody's doing exactly what they're told. They raise their hand. They stand up. They sit down. They turn around. Everything is done according to the way it's supposed to be done, and then that's the way you develop an army, which is fine. I mean, I don't know that, I can't say that there's anything right or wrong about it one way or the other. But what is probably the most disturbing thing is that it doesn't allow for promote any creativity. And so therefore, and I'm not talking about, taking cans of paint and throwing them at a wall. I'm talking about creativity in terms of scientific investigation, the ability to be able to, what they call, think outside the box. We talk about thinking outside the box, but nobody really does it. You know, they just develop a bigger box or develop a different shape box and call it thinking outside the box. The point is that if you look at the innovation and the developmental process that goes on in a country, for example, like in Israel, where the educational process, nurtures that individualized thinking and that ability to promote individualized, unique approaches to situations and concepts, then you see that most of the major computer inventions today and applications are all coming out of Israel. Somebody was pointing out online that technology where there's in the Olympics, you see a guy swimming into the wall and then the flag of his country suddenly appears and you say, oh yeah, the American guy won or the Russian guy won or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. That's a technology that was developed in Israel. The sensors on the side of the wall, the clocks, that's also in those Israeli technology. The line that goes across the football field, I guess all Israel does is develops applications for sports. Oh, anyhow, so I mean, I don't know, but you know what I'm saying. The point I'm making is that we are in America. I say we in America, so I'm putting my foot on the other side of the ocean right now. But there's an opportunity here to say, look, let's listen to what these, Shimon Wernick is doing an amazing job in PS770. He's invited me to come over and spend time there, which I plan to do when I return. So if you're listening, Shimon, I am coming. And he has done some amazing things. His concept of education is this group of, six guys there? Unbelievable what they have come up with. And, of course, there's going to be, everybody's going to resist it. You're going to have the teachers' unions and the head of the school districts and all these people. Everyone, the parents are going to come unglued. But in the end, as they say in Israel, kol hachala kasha. Every new beginning has difficulties with it, and nothing starts easy. You know, nothing begins easy. So what we have to do really is sit down and listen to what these fellows are saying, because they are providing. And by the way, I think there is, if I'm not mistaken, they're almost all Spanish-speaking fellows, including the Chassid Shimon Wernick, who is a Lubavitcher. He also speaks Spanish, and was one of his great tools in changing a violent school in the Bronx one of the most productive and highest scoring and highest producing academic schools in the whole city of New York. So he did a remarkable job there. He's already proven that he's got the capability and the capacity to make changes. He was also in the Army, as was I. You know, we served in the same Army. I served in two. I don't want to go into both armies, you know. And by the way, we got fitted for our gas masks. Everybody here has gas masks now. But that's just a PS. We'll talk about that on Tuesday. But the point I'm making is that we have the opportunity at this moment in time to move forward from the Horace Mann mentality and from the understanding of and developing education as a rote continuum to developing it into something that is completely new and will provide opportunities. You know, not everybody's going to come out a genius in linguistics or in mathematics, but everybody does have potential to be smart at something. And whatever you're smart at, that's what we should be focusing on and spending time developing your talent, and stop worrying about everybody fitting into the same box. Okay, Dennis, let me step off my box here. Okay, go ahead.
Dennis, your thoughts on these matters.
I like the theory of universality that you mentioned was the basis for the Mann book concept and theories. However, it has evolved today into a practical matter devoid of God. Yes, we can train people to be soldiers and everything like that, but without God, you're missing some purpose in there, and you cannot have human goals. I mean, we just get stuck in a rut when that happens. And the other point I'd like to make is that when you talk about God, you bring in spirituality or supernatural type of concepts. Why? Because God has to be explained as above humanity. So therefore, you bring in a whole new world of the supernatural. Not that you emphasize it, but you must recognize that it's there. If you are devoid of all this in a school or an education or a learning process, are you really learning everything you should be acquainted with? I don't know. I'm not deciding this, that, or the other thing. But I do know the old way that it was done, the original way it was done, that all learning...
Dennis?
...was basically in conjunction with God in some way, shape, or form. That's how most of learning began. There was nothing wrong with that. Humans have made a great strides.
You know, Dennis, you're 100% correct. If you go to Europe... 80% of the society there believes in God as a result of their education. You go to the United States, and I think if you look at the public system, I think the numbers are, I don't know if they're even equal, but they're reversed. The majority of people do not believe in God or do not have a relationship with God, and the minority does. So somebody's educating. Somebody has an educational system that's working and providing a depth of education and simultaneously a divine relationship at the same time. And I think that's wherein you're 100% correct. I agree with that. I think what we what's really missing here is that we don't emphasize the every single one of us gets up and we have our entire day, we're totally connected to God and not aware of it. if you're there and you're plugged in, and you just never turn on the switch, well, all that current is shooting through the system as it was designed to, but nothing's coming on. There's no spiritual bulb, and that's really what's missing. I agree with you.
Beautiful.
No
gentlemen,
arguments here.
No. What? Listen, we can agree to disagree and disagree to agree. I mean, as of many times, you and I are.
Hey,
we have a certain.
Don't try to come in here and start trouble, okay?
But basically, we again, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, we are not the truth and the light. We're presenting teachings, and this is definitely a Torah discussion, but we're talking about human welfare, and because if you're talking about human welfare in terms of an educational system, a mind system, a mindset, a social system, we're talking about loving your neighbor as you love yourself. But before we move on, gentlemen, and hopefully you can stand for the second half, Eliezer, there's an idea that there's not enough love in the world. So therefore, we humbly advocate to everyone to train in love, and one of the ways to get to train in love is to hear the following song. This goes back to 1972. I'm sure Eliezer and Dennis, when they hear this song, they're going to have warm, fond memories of their bottom bell, blue, what are they called?
Wait, are you going to sing, "All You Need Is Love"?
No. Do you remember the OJ's Love
Train?
We're going to break out
no?
with the, we're going to
okay,
break out
right,
with
good.
The OJ's Love Train, because it's a song that goes back to my youth. And I just think of this song. I look down at my legs. I remember at the bottom of my trousers used to be bell bottoms. So anyway, hold on. This is the Love Train. Let's train in love. Let's hold on for about the next 3 minutes and 5 seconds. Give us a chance to take a deep breath and go into the second half of the show. Hold on, everyone.
Okay.
Don't you know that it's time to get on board? And let this train keep on riding, riding on through. Where? Come on, world, don't give up. Party, come on, don't train.
Ezra and Dennis, are you thinking about your bell bottoms from 1972?
You are one kind of a nutty Jew, I want to tell you that. Listen, we got all these Arabs and Jews up here dancing and everything. Okay, everybody. All right, go back to your jobs. Okay, I had the speakers on here. Everybody was dancing.
Don?
Okay, that's it. Everybody back to work. All right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes, Dennis.
Since we have the good doctor, I'd like to bring up that subject of Down syndrome. Why? Because I remember 50, 60 years ago, Down syndrome was described as humans who weren't going to live long because they couldn't live, they were deficient, and therefore you couldn't do anything for them other than pity them. But today, and my wife has a couple of relatives who are in the Down syndrome category, as well as my neighbor across the street, and some of these people are 30 and 40 years old now. And they are participating and actually doing things. And people are listening to them without seeing their Down syndrome. And to me, this is an advance to humanity. Is that not so, Doctor?
Well, I don't know if it's an advance to society. I don't know anybody who's davening to have a child with Down syndrome. But in answer to your question, truthfully, there was a time early 1900 America, when the infant mortality rate was significantly high, not just higher than it is now, but significantly high, which meant that in order to survive the birthing and infantile process, meant that you were one of the few. So aside from having Down syndrome, just being an infant in America at that time meant that your mortality rate was limited. And so therefore what happened was everyone was passing away at an earlier age. And when you have a significant number of people that are passing away in infancy, even if they grow to be, if the rest of the population at that point grows to be 60 or 70 years old, it pulls the numbers down to 40 or 50, because you know just the average of I don't have to explain to you the statistical average there, but the point is that if a person passes away in foster home in infancy, and the counterpart grows to be 80 years old, the mean age of survival was 40. So that's the point, was that that's changed. It's not that the Down syndrome has changed so much. I mean, our ability to identify it certainly has, but our ability to survive past birth and to develop beyond the adolescent and young adult age without running into these severe diseases and injuries and the kinds of, you know, I mean, our safety features on the job have increased significantly, and our ability to fight health problems and serious disease. And so therefore, yes, you're right. We do see more people who are surviving, who have Down syndrome past a certain age. But we also are seeing the whole population survive past a certain age now, because the application of the survival process is pretty much equally applied to everyone in the society, and so we've all benefited from that. But what we have learned from the process of dealing with people who have Down syndrome, which is what you're alluding to, is the fact that you have neighbors and so forth and so on, and we've learned by being neighbors with good neighbors who happen to have Down syndrome that they're just like my daughter's group always says, you know, the only thing different with us is we just have an extra chromosome. And that's the bottom line. If you take away the Down syndrome from the person and just look at the person, you're suddenly looking at a process or a human being that may have a limited function but has intelligence. We just haven't tapped into that person's intelligence. And it doesn't mean just because you have Down syndrome that you want to do the same job that everybody else who has Down syndrome wants to do. And you said this was your 47th show, right?
Yes.
Huh?
Yes, it is the 47th.
Yeah, so how many chromosomes in somebody who has trisomy 21? 47 chromosomes. My gosh, you guys are amazing. There's 23 total. There's 22 chromosomes in a, and then the 23rd pair is the autosomes, which determine the gender of the child. And then, in a child who has Down syndrome, you have trisomy 21. You have three at the 21st pair, so you have 23, and 23 is 46, and the extra one is 47. And this is program number
47.
47. There you go.
Okay.
Well, doctor,
you, I see that you took you exploited this. You took advantage of this. You tricked me. I just can't believe you did this. But okay, I'm happy you did.
Doctor, thank you. But also implied in my question was that public opinion has changed about Down syndrome.
Oh, absolutely.
Because
yes.
those old fears and mistrust of thinking that these were seriously affected people that weren't going to live long has been changed.
Well, you know, it's funny that you asked that question, that very question, because before I left New York, I was actually with someone who stopped me on the street. I was with my son, Mendy, who's with me here, and and the guy looked at me and said, if I touch him, is it contagious?
No.
So, yes, you're right. We have developed a long, long way, but that doesn't mean we've reached everyone. You know, there are still some, you know, I guess some dark corners of the world where, you know, the light hasn't yet, been allowed in. Once the light illuminates, you're right, 100%. I remember as a kid, you know, that it was those kids, you know, you have to be, watch out for those kids. But today, people don't have that attitude or that approach at all. I think you see that, as you're implying, we've come out of the closet, so to speak, and, you know, people are no longer afraid, and therefore, the person themselves who has the trisomy or the Down syndrome is also no longer fearful, and so therefore they feel the level of acceptance and the level of camaraderie that never existed when you and I were kids. I don't know when you were a kid, but I was a kid like back in the days of the covered wagon, maybe. So. just ask my kids if you think I'm kidding on that one. Hey, Todd, did they have cars when you were born? I said, I don't know. I wasn't, you know, I was just a baby.
So
anyhow,
the original cars had hand cranks in front of them.
What?
I remember cars when they had the original hand cranks in front of them.
Wow. Yeah, of course.
Wow.
It turned it around and spun it around, and that's how they started. That was the starter motor.
That was it?
Yeah, that's a big key to have on your keychain now.
True. Dennis, I'd like to move on to the next section. This is section
between that and the skeleton keys to get into all the closets, you know.
We'd like to move on to the next section with Dennis. We'll be reading now, and this will be juicy because now we'll have Rabbi Goldstock or Rabbi Dr. Goldstock comment on it. From Moses Maimonides.
Yeah, I got to get going. So are you going to finish up with Dennis?
Well, we have about 40 minutes to go. If you got to go, 40? Thank you very much. About 40 minutes.
Yeah, I will try to listen to the rest of the program. I really want to thank you guys very much for allowing me to come in and participate, and I really appreciate it. I'm listening to your show, and I'm enjoying it immensely, and thanks again for having me.
Thank you, and I'd like to remind everyone that this coming Tuesday, as we've been doing it since, I think, late December, Rabbi Goldstock and I are doing a tutorial. It's called Getting to the Heart of the Matter, where we do explorations into the world of Down/Up syndrome, and hopefully Rabbi Goldstock will give us some more good news. He has a new center called Machon Lashir Lezimra, the Center for Song, and two expressions of song. Say the Center for Song and Song would be redundant, but rather I like to look at it as a place where you'll hear the emanation of the songs of joy coming from human voices and the emanation of the songs of joy coming from the angelic voices in praise of the pioneering work that him and his wife, Chanatov, have been doing for the last 20-plus years, and now is reaching a new plateau in trying to educate families and help them if they want to make aliyah, to move to Israel and have their children get ingratiated and educated how to live in the Middle East and not in Flatbush, New York. So So I'd like to thank you, Eliezer, and hopefully everyone who's listening.
Nice meeting you, Dennis.
Very enjoyable, Doctor.
Thank you. Me too.
Eliezer,
I enjoyed it very much.
And I just want to mention, too, we might as well say publicly, we'll have a special place this coming Tuesday, when Eliezer, Rabbi Galtuk's on live with me. Recently, Professor Ross Barnard of Queensland, Australia, coined us as the Abbott and Costello of the soul. So hopefully we're going to have a response to that. So, Dennis, here you have it. You have two Jewish guys who have been called the Abbott and Costello of the soul. Hey, Abbott!
And we all love you.
Okay, take care, Eliezer.
Okay, take it easy, Dennis.
Okay, Dennis. That's welcome to the world of not just Jewish activism, but Jewish rabbis. We all have a little bit of comedy in us, and cause if you're too serious, it's not good. And
I've always appreciated Jewish humor, so there's no problem.
Hey, I just look in the mirror. I have only jokes to make. You know, it's funny, Dennis, before we go on to the next section with your reading from Rambam, that in Hebrew, the Hebrew word for body is called goof. Now, in English, goof has another implication, and you have the character goofy. So, you know, when our bodies are not acting as we would want them to be, whatever, through voluntary, involuntary actions, we just say, listen, my goof is called a goof, so if I get goofy, I'm not surprised. My body is called a goof. Anyway, Dennis.
Anyway, we're on page 119, Don. Are you there?
Okay. I am turning the pages. And
what we're doing is we're talking about ethics now. And ethics is something that humans have a hard time dealing with because it interferes with the rationalization we use sometimes.
True. So I'm ready, Dennis.
It begins, and this is written by Alexander Brody as he presented it at the symposium for Maimonides.
Okay.
There is much to be said of the view that the moral philosophy of Maimonides is, at the least, in broad outline, Aristotelian. As regards the details of the relation between the moral philosophies of the two men, there are ample grounds for uncertainty. It is, however, generally agreed that, at the level of detail, Maimonides is no mere echo. But if the relationship is not one of echo to source, what is it? Here I shall develop a partial answer, one focused upon Maimonides' teaching on virtue and vice and upon his employment of medical categories in dealing with moral philosophical concepts. Though Maimonides follows Aristotle in employing a version of the doctrine of the mean in his discussion of moral states, his perspective upon that doctrine is substantially different from that of Aristotle. The difference, roughly stated, is that Maimonides' perspective is that of a doctor interested in restorative medicine, whereas Aristotle's perspective is that of a doctor interested in preventive medicine. I shall not seek to argue that Aristotle believed the model of restorative medicine wholly inapplicable to moral philosophy, nor do I think that such an account of Aristotle can be sustained. However, it is possible to provide a strong defense for the claim that the model plays a prominent and key role in Maimonides' moral philosophy, and that, on the contrary, it plays only a minor role in Aristotle's. My starting point is the concept of health, of which Maimonides makes free use of his discussions and virtue. He writes, "The health of the soul consists of its condition and that of its parts being such that it always does good and fine things and performs noble actions. Its sickness consists of its condition and that of the parts being such that they always does bad and ugly things and perform base actions."
Mm-hmm.
End of quote from Maimonides. It is possible that these two accounts are intended to read as definitions per genus differentium of health of soul and of its sickness. If so, the genus in each case is the condition of the soul and its parts, and the differentiate are the specific features of that condition which result in the soul performing the acts it does. The acts of the healthy soul are fine and normal. Those of the sick soul, the opposite. Given Mayamati's abiding interest in unequivocal and univocal and equivocal predication, one might wonder whether the term healthy is being used univocally when predicted of body and soul. It is not certain what the answer is to this question, but it is plain that he believes that there to be at least a very close similarity in signification between the term healthy predicated of body and of soul. Mayamati speaks of vice, as we have noted, as a sickness of the soul, and he held that the proper treatment, for it is formally identical with the proper treatment for physical ailments. His prescriptions is based upon the doctrine of the mean, and this is a quote.
Mm-hmm.
Should a man's soul become sick, he must follow the same course in treating it as in the medical treatment for bodies. For when the body gets out of equilibrium, we look to which side it inclines in becoming unbalanced, and then oppose it with its contrary until it returns to equilibrium. When it is in equilibrium, we remove the counterbalance and revert it to which keeps the body in equilibrium. We act in a similar manner with regard to the moral habits.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, a lot of stuff here. First, I mean, I have to admit, Dennis, I am not familiar with Aristotle's viewpoint of preventative medicine, and I'm just trying to understand it in terms of my mind's restorative medicine, because from one perspective, I don't really differentiate the difference between restoring something and preventing, other than that, unless what you just read is the fuel that propels the engine of Maimonides' viewpoint on restorative medicine. You know, and also this idea of the health of the soul as opposed to when it does good things, and as opposed to its sickness being incurred by doing bad things. I mean, these are very, very general statements, which the soul in itself is above good and bad, but yet I think he's talking about the level of soul as it relates to that level of soul energy or soulfulness, which is enclosed in the human body experience. So I this is kind of out of my league, because the areas that you're quoting from or they quoted from Rambam, I am not fully learned in. Not that I'm going to be fully learned in any part of Rambam, but as a student of Rambam, certainly I personally need to learn more about these things before I can make any sort of more assertive type of commentaries. But I'd like to, maybe you can recapitulate your views on this, and we also have another. Yeah.
What happens is we're talking about two people who are a millennium apart. So the original thinking by Aristotle was very crude, basic, and he didn't understand the full concept of God. But here comes Hades a millennium later and says, wait a minute, we got to rethink these things, restructure them, and fit them in their right place, because we should know more by now. So the passing of history has an effect on here. And the quotes you don't recognize from Mayamati's is because they're from non-rabbinical sources. So he wrote a lot of stuff, and the word ethics here, he began from a philosophical viewpoint, not from a theological viewpoint. Later on, he blended them and melded them together as to how they work in unison. But his writings that I read there were things that soul, in other words, you are in control of your soul. When you get a soul, you get a pure soul. But if you want to subvert your soul into something, well, then how can you expect something good to come out of it? So, no, he's not attacking the concept of soul from a philosophical viewpoint. He's talking about more of a practical nature. So his reflections and his speaking on this, again, which is non-rabbinical, is sort of strange, or maybe some people would say, wait a minute, are we talking about two different Mayamatis? No. He was one person.
True. And the trail that he blazed, Dennis, he is so far behind, far beyond, and so ahead of front of the majority of the history human consciousness, we'll always be running after him. I don't think we'll ever catch up to Maimonides, but if we travel the path, each one according to their abilities, to learn his teachings, which can be the most complex of the complex teachings of the Torah, to the simplest of the simplest allegorical teachings, even to be found in his letters to different Jewish communities, and his instructions to the Caliph, you called it in Egypt. It was a title for the Egyptian ruler at that time.
You had it right, Don.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. So, Dennis, I thank you for that. I'd like to now turn to a book called The Teachings of
Maimonides. Wait a minute, because
I'd
like to make a statement, and that is, Maimonides was such a person who basically came out with the second Bible or the second Torah. No.
Right. Well, I'm going to talk about that now.
Well, let me explain. He also redid what history considered the greatest thinkers in our time, the Greeks. He revised it and brought it up to date and corrected a lot of their thinking. Now, the mind of Maimonides should have been placed in a thing of honor on the earth here. It hasn't yet, but a lot of people still believe in him, and we respect it.
Thank you, Dennis. So we'd like to now use that as a segue into the teachings of Maimonides, by J. Jacob S. Minkin. I'd like to read a short portion of it. This is an introduction to that book, and this is going to talk about something you alluded to, Dennis. So the commentary on the Mishnah foreshadowed Maimonides' majestic summation and reworking of all rabbinical literature in the book, which he boldly called Mishnah Torah. And Minkin suggests that I think this title is best translated as Teachings of the Tradition, thus inviting comparison to the second century Mishnah itself, which is composed by Rabbi Judah the Prince. In his long work, Maimonides codified all of Jewish law in 14 major sections, each with many subsections. He announced his purpose in this introduction, that he intended a book that laymen could consult. It would no longer be necessary for anyone except the occasional scholar to study rabbinic literature or to have recourse to the scholarly keepers of its mysteries. Maimonides opened his code not with ritual or civil rules, but with statement of what theological doctrines Jews must believe in. He was particularly insistent that God was incorporeal and that all biblical references to him as a person were concessions to human speech, which you've mentioned many times, Dennis, in the past. This assertion enraged his literalist critics. Many of them were even angrier that one man, even though one of the acknowledged genius, was setting himself up as the supreme arbiter of Jewish law. One more paragraph. The Mishnah Torah was the only book that Maimonides wrote in Hebrew. It was, well, now, the good news is it's translated to English and to other languages, at least parts of it. It was and remains, in addition to its legal importance, a classic composition in the sacred language. Nonetheless, this most Jewish and rabbinic of Maimonides' works was not so self-contained as it appeared. It owed a deep debt to Islamic models. Islam, like Judaism, is a religion of commandments and of law. In the earliest centuries, after the Quran was composed, precepts and decisions in every aspect of human life, from religious ritual to political conduct, was derived from its text or from authoritative accounts of the life of the Prophet, referring to Muhammad. During the 9th century, two major collections of traditions called Hadith were published by Islamic scholars Al-Bukhari and Al-Hajjaj, sorry if I'm not pronouncing that name correctly, called Muslim. Such codes continued to be composed for the next 3 centuries, and some were produced even during Maimonides' lifetime. These works contain not only rules about ritual and civil and political conduct, they also set down firmly what a Muslim had to believe. So Maimonides' approach to codifying Jewish law was thus in keeping with the quote-unquote spirit of the age. Even though he nowhere mentions any of the Muslim codifiers, the structure and the organization of the Mishnah Torah show that Maimonides was more than aware of Islamic models. Now, that should not come to shock to some people, because what Maimonides was a man of humility that you can pull from the best of all worlds in order to transmit what you feel to be essential for the masses, which ranges from the laymen to the greatest of scholars. Dennis, your comments on the Maimonides' approach and not being afraid to include a system predicated on his awareness of Islamic models of education.
Maimonides was one of those people that had no fear. how many people could think of rewriting the Bible in any way, shape, or form, and all the body of works that existed at the time to take on that? Wow. To reinvent the Greeks, to put them in perspective in the correct way? No, he had no fear. But the one thing we do know is that when he was growing up in Cordoba, that was under Arabic rule, okay, the Almohades was the tribe at the time, he was lectured and he learned in the Arabic way.
Uh-huh.
And their structure of school and their structure of how they present subjects and go through it and build on things and everything, that was in his heart. He just absorbed that like a giant sponge. So we do see in a lot of his writings, especially in philosophical writings, where he feels bad for Islamics because he loved them and he understood them and he understood their way of thinking and their methodology. And he carefully pointed out where they took the wrong term in the wrong turn in terms of theology. And he hasn't forgiven them for that because he always reminds his readers, and his readers, he doesn't care if you're a scholar or a man in the street. There's always something in it that you can grab or use or feel like it's part of you. But anyway, getting back to the Islamics, yes, he always had a separate place in his heart for that. But he couldn't understand why they couldn't accept from their oral history or their oral teachings that the world was created out of nothing by God.
Oh, Dennis, I only wish that this type of dialogue could reach into the minds and hearts and ears of those who seem hell-bent into destruction, whatever side of the coin, whether it be Islamic theologians or Christian theologians. And I hate to say it, there are some even Jewish theologians who want to see some sort of apocalyptic outcome, which they think will be the forerunning, the preparation for the coming of the Mashiach, which there are plenty of authentic Torah, written and oral Torah teachings, which testify to the opposite. But what you're saying, I think, and what we're talking about is so huge to see that there doesn't have to be this conflict between the Jewish and the Arab and the Christian civilizations, because we used to, 800 years ago, we had our intellectual think tank, to try to make it a better world. Your take on that, Dennis?
A better world, yes. Maimonides laid a groundwork that a lot of non-Jewish people have used, and they expounded on it. And some of that became the basis for the Catholic Church, even. And even today, there's a lot of Christian thinking that is based on the philosophy and partly the theology that Maimonides set up. And it's hard to refute his logic because he proves it with his logic. He doesn't present an opinion. It's not him. He is not presenting himself. He is a conduit of what is true.
Amen. Thank you, Dennis. We'd like to move on to the next section. We've got about 20 minutes to go. A brief teaching from Rabbi Nachman of Breslev. This one of the ways a couple weeks ago I couldn't find the book. I found the book this week. This is talking about one of the 48 ways that one can acquire the Torah, meaning how do you acquire Torah, meaning how do you internalize and live with the teachings just as you take in and internalize the food that you eat and the drinks that you sip upon. So Rabbi Nachman teaches the following. One of the 48 ways to acquire the Torah, again, to make it one with yourself, halomed al manat lasot, meaning a person learns on the condition to do. And he goes on to say, you should know, my beloved, my son, that the essential acquisition of the Torah, which I read acquisition/internalization, is to learn on the condition that you try to do something with your teaching, to fulfill what you have learned. And also it's brought down from the Midrash that the learning is not the essence, but rather taking it to action. Because an action can actually atone for a person, and that when a person is engaging in acts which are positive to atone upon themselves, they're engaging in the act of repentance, and their acts of repentance, tshuva, and their good actions can actually turn away evil decrees from themselves and their loved ones. And in that process of learning on the condition to do, not only is a person doing good and engaging in repentance and atoning for themselves, that also they're going to magnify, their intellect will become clearer to absorb the concepts that they are trying to learn. In fact, it's written about in another section in the Ethics of Our Fathers that a person whose wisdom is greater than his acts is like a tree that has very shallow roots. A wind shall come along and knock down that tree. Dennis, your viewpoint on the idea that, yes, we can get wise and become wise men, either in our own eyes or actually generally wise, but if we don't combine it with acts based upon, predicated upon the wisdom we're learning, we're not really developing deep roots in terms of being really rooted in the consciousness we claim to be comprehending.
Well, that goes back to the concept of sitting on it. If you do nothing and sit on it, what do you expect? More of the same? Well, if you get more of the same, then that's boring, isn't it? So your expectation is it has no future if you're doing more of the same. In the New Testament, there's an anecdotal explanation of talents. Now, talent at the time, years ago, was a specie used for monetary purposes. But to me, I like to use the word talent as it is in English today. If you sit on your talent, what do you expect the outcome to be? I mean, the anecdotal thing goes that there was an old man who had a very rich, had a big farm, and he had three sons, and he didn't know which son to leave it to. So he gave them X amount of talents and told them to come back in X amount of years, and we'll discuss who is my heir. So one son came back and said, "Father, you should be proud of me. I took all the money you gave me, and I buried it in the ground." The next son came up and said, "Gee, Dad, I tried to do something with it, but I gambled, and I lost the whole thing." The third son came up and said, "Gee, I went on and bought a couple of more farms, and I'm doing pretty good, Dad." Well, it was obvious to see which one was picked to be the heir of the fortune. But why would the person, the human, bury it in the ground thinking that something was going to happen? Mm-hmm. You cannot sit on your talents.
Beautiful. Thank you, Dennis. With that being said, I would like to go on to the next section of our program, reading from, and this is a wonder, I hope these next two teachings will really open up people's eyes to authentic Torah teachings and rethink about how they have been taught many distorted teachings about what oral and written Torah traditions are for the Jewish people as it relates to the whole world. And it goes as follows. This is, again, from Rabbi David Sears' Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition. It reads like this. And this is, I'd say, this type of statement taught by Rabbi Avraham Yitzhak Kook, who was a chief rabbi in Israel up until the early 1930s, in his explanation of a teaching from the Zohar, goes as follows. And it's a very, how should we say, I think he is setting a stage for real dialogue with the following teaching. So I'd like to share it with you right now. Judaism's view on other religions, and this is what he says. "As for other religions, in my opinion, it is not the goal of Israel's light to uproot or destroy them, just as we do not aim for the general destruction of the world and all its nations, but rather their correction and elevation and the removal of their dross. Then of themselves they shall join the source of Israel, from whence a dew of light will flow upon them. As it says in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 7, quote, and I will take away the blood from his mouth and his detestable things from between his teeth, and he too shall remain for our God," end of quote. This applies even to idolatry, all the more so to those religions that are partially based upon the light of Israel's Torah. "Great are the words of the Vilna Gaon of blessed memory, who quotes the prophet Malachi," or Malachi in Hebrew, chapter 1, verse 3, quote, "and I hated Esau," or Esau. So what is referring to God? Why would God hate Esau? Now this is referring to, Rabbi Kook promotes, refers to that which is inferior in Esau. "However, that which is primary to him, his head, is according to the Midrash, buried together with the patriarchs of the world in the cave of Machpelah," which happens to be in Hebron, where Adam and Eve are buried, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca, and Jacob, Israel, with Leah. "Hence Jacob, the man of simplicity, the man of truth, said, when he saw his brother Esav, Esau. And he says, you can go there yourselves, but see in Genesis chapter 33, verse 10, I beheld your face as after I beheld the face of God. And if his words will not be left unfulfilled, the brotherly love of Esau, which is the progenitor of the Christian nations, and Jacob, Isaac, and Ishmael, Ishmael being the progenitor of the Islamic nations, will rise above those upheavals, above the evil consequences of the body's profane desires, and will overcome them and turn them into light and eternal loving kindness. This broad knowledge, sweetening the honey of the Torah of truth, must accompany us all in our paths as to the end of days, to seal the Torah in the palace of the king with the Messiah by turning bitterness to sweetness and darkness to light. Dennis, your take on these words.
I object to the rabbi's use of the word partial that you mentioned in that statement, Don. It's a lot more than partial. Why? Because the Torah and the 613 laws have a lot of common sense in them. And people will practice common sense. They don't need to know that a famous Jewish person 2,000 years ago said this or recommended it, but they'll go ahead and do it anyway. Not because he said it, because they don't even know he said it. But there is common sense. And that common sense is justification for a positive thought on the future. So therefore, I believe that people who've been on the planet long enough understand that there's certain things that must be done, that we are obligated to do. And people do it without having the education to understand it. So therefore, we do have a lot in common, and to distinguish our differences is a complete waste of time.
I hear you. I'd like to quote also now from Rabbi Yaakov Emden, another brave soul who lived, I think he was born over 300 years ago, but he lived into the 18th century. This is a commentary that he has on the fourth Mishnah, fourth chapter of the Mishnah, the 13th Mishnah. And he was very taken aback by the false Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi, who lived in the 17th century, and was involved in misusing what is known as the Kabbalah to engage and promote publicly lewdness, and eventually he was brought before the leader of Turkey. I forget the name of the title, please excuse me. And he was threatened that if he did not convert, he would die. And Shabtai Tzvi converted and became a Muslim. And then the anger that was incurred upon the Jewish community led to a great massacre of Jewish people by the Noahides of those times. So Rabbi Emden was engaged in a good portion, if not the majority of his life, in rectifying the consciousness and awareness and responsibilities among Jewish people, Christians, and people of the Islamic faith. This is a teaching from Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Christians and Muslims must be regarded as an instrument for the fulfillment of the prophecy that the knowledge of God will one day spread throughout the earth. Whereas the nations before them worshipped idols, denied God's existence, and did not recognize God's power or his retribution, the rise of Christianity and Islam served to spread among the nations to the farthest ends of the earth to the knowledge that there is one God who governs the world, who rewards and punishes and reveals himself to man. Christian scholars have not only won acceptance among the nations for the revelation of the written law, the Torah, but has also have helped to safeguard God's oral law, the Talmud and rabbinic tradition, which includes, of course, the teachings of Rambam and Mishnah Torah. For when in their hostility to the Torah, ruthless persons in their own midst sought to abrogate and uproot the Talmud, others from among those, meaning the Christians and Muslim communities, arose to defend it and to repulse those attempts. Dennis, any commentary on that?
I believe in that general statement because we're all children of God. And even though we say we practice different religions, we're really practicing it to the same God. So we do have a lot in common, even though we're afraid to admit it. But I wish more religious people would speak up when it comes to political matters and arguments among countries or even people. But that is part of the fabric of humanity. And your belief is what you hope to attain. So therefore, to pretend that you're not really trying to attain anything or increase your beliefs, you're wasting time when that comes around. So therefore, even Maimonides, when he wrote, yes, he wasn't for murder, but the one thing that really angered him, and he really ever got mad that I can ever read about him, was in a letter to the Yemenites, where a false rabbi who was saying he had some messianic capabilities or whatever it was, that the Maimonides wrote and said, well, don't pretend, don't even go along with this guy. Do what you believe in. Place your faith in the Lord, and he will come up with his just desserts. Unfortunately, that's what happened. But that's a positive story.
Right. Yep. We're going to now turn to The Path of the Righteous Gentile by Rabbi Chaim Klorfin and Rabbi Yaakov Rogalski. And we're in the section that talks about the seven laws of the children of Noah. And we want to start off by saying that, again, this is a teaching, I believe, from Maimonides. Let me just go to the section in the back for a second here. Let's see here. Just bear with me 1 minute, friends. Yeah. So this would be a teaching from the Babylonian Talmud, that when one of the children of Noah, which is the nations of the world, engage in the study of the seven universal laws, he is able to attain a spiritual level higher than the high priest of the Jewish people, who alone, meaning the high priest of the Jews, who alone had the sanctity to enter the Holy of Holies in the Temple of Jerusalem. Now, with that being said, it is incorrect to think that since the children of Israel have 613 commandments and the children of Noah have 7 commandments, the ratio of spiritual worth is proportionally 613 to 7. The truth must be told that the 7 universal commandments or laws are general commandments, each containing many parts and details, meaning there are commandments within the commandments, whereas the 613 commandments of the Torah are specific, each relating to one basic detail of the divine law. Therefore, the numerical disparity in Noah reflects the relative spiritual worth of the two systems of commandments. The prime difference in the service of the Israelite and of that of the Noahide is that the Noahide should recognize existence of existence, that is to say, to engage that consciousness and to integrate that consciousness into refining the world, whereas the Israelite sees the non-existence of existence, that is, reveals godliness in the world. Of course, refining the world reveals its inherent godliness, and revealing godliness automatically refines the world. And I just want to point out something here that doesn't exclude the Jew, the Israelite, whatever you want to call us, from refining the world. And today, because so many teachings have now been made accessible, being translated from the Arabic or the Yiddish or the Hebrew into English, now a Noahide has the option, if they want to explore these teachings about the non-existence of existence, which Dennis has talked about and said that this is something he talked about earlier with Rambam. So we both have a symbiotic relationship in terms of, number one, elevating the world, refining it to a state of higher goodness, in preparation for the ultimate goodness, for the universal redemption, and as well, according to our spiritual palates, to want to go into how this world, which is of substance and being, comes from ultimately a state of non-existence of being, because this is the will and wisdom of our blessed Creator. Dennis, any comments, questions, and concerns, feedback from your part?
Yeah, well, we all have a lot in common, and we have a lot of uncommon things. But one thing that humans like to do is argue about the numbers as to what was first, what was second. Matter of fact, the original Ten Commandments it was broken out into 3 different numerics, which was hard for me to understand at first. The first was the Philonic division that was based on Philo and Josephus in the first century. There was a Talmudic division that came out in the 3rd century, and there was, in the 5th century, an Augustinian division. And all three did not agree on the exact numbering of the Ten Commandments. So here we have, over a series of centuries, where humans are arguing about the numbers between 1 through 10. Well, now, so much for getting together and agreeing on things. So... humans like to argue about these because everybody thinks they know the numbers from 1 to 10, and you're not going to tell them it's any other way. Therefore, my way is perfect. Your way is something else. So we've had these arguments, but we're not arguing about the content. We're arguing about the sequence. The sequence is immaterial. Because if you learn or you absorb Torah as opposed to acquiring over a period of time, you may not learn the whole thing. But it has been said over the history of mankind that the Ten Commandments are there. But the 613 laws explain them and help you to understand them. So what is lost here? Are we talking about human indexing? Are we talking about my numbers are greater than yours? Numbers are a convention. They come and go. God is here to stay, and the content is more important.
Beautiful, Dennis. We're going to now move into the last section of the program, which I mentioned to you, which we hope we will talk about. This is now going back to Genesis chapter 2, verse 16, and it reads as follows. Talking about sequence here. God commanded the human, saying, quote, of every tree of the garden you may eat freely, end of quote. So here we see actually, blessed souls, after this, in the second chapter, another, I believe the first chapter of Genesis has 31 verses. Let me just check here for 1 second. That's what I saw yesterday. Hopefully my mind is still... Yeah, we had 31 verses in the first chapter. No mention of any commandments, but there was mentioning of man. And it was mentioning the fact that we all are blessed and anointed with a divine image. Now we're brought to the first time to the realization that God had commanded the human, the man, which also means woman. So from the oral Torah tradition, we understand that, what does this mean, God commanded the human? Now, first of all, I have to mention from the Kabbalistic teachings of the Zohar that the idea of command means safta or chibor, meaning when God is commanding you, he's not just telling you to do this and don't do that. He is giving you a way of connecting to him. So what would have God have commanded human, original human beings, Adam and Eve, in the Garden of Eden? In the broadest sense, he was teaching them the entire Torah, the entire instruction, meaning it not necessarily would be the Torah that we would learn today because there was no Israel, because they weren't Israelites. There was not the various commandments that we learn today because a lot of those commandments are known as testimonial commandments, which testify of us going out of Egypt. There was no Egypt in the time of Adam and Eve. But rather, what they were taught, that in that idea of connecting to the Most High, he taught them the purpose of creation, the proper way to live, and how to relate to the world, eventually the manifestation of rules as it would relate to societal conventions. And he instructed them that there was a certain way he wanted his children, all of humanity, all of the human family experience to follow, and how to ascend the ladder of spiritual and divine consciousness. And all of these divine ideas and notions were later embodied in the Torah as we know it today. So talking about sequence, though, we do see here, Dennis, and blessed souls, the first time the expression of command was given. But Dennis, aside from that, any comments you have I would love to hear, but why is it that we people hear about, oh, there are commandments, they get bent out of shape by the word of command? What is it in that word command that is so threatening to the human being, to saying, I don't need to be commanded by anyone, even God himself?
Well, funny you should bring that up, Don, because that's a sore point with me. Most of my Jewish friends bristle at word command. Yes, they believe that they're following, so why do they have to be commanded? So anyway, besides that, they will sometimes quibble and rationalize, well, the word command really is a saying or a matter or an opinion. But when God gave us the Ten Commandments, he didn't give us a command. He gave us an obligation.
Right.
So they came from God. It is not time to quibble about the English word that's being used here because the content is more important, just like the sequencing. If someone wants to use this word instead of that word, are you going to question God's motives based on that? horse feathers. You can't do that. You're creating false stuff all over the place. So if it's an obligation, we do it. Whatever English word you want to attach to it, so be it. But between you and God, it's an obligation, whether he commanded you or not. But he didn't give it to you as a suggestion that you can take it or leave it. No, you can't believe that. It came from God. It was handed down by Moses. Those things are inviolate. We must believe in them. We are not going to quibble about the word that's being used, because the word is not as important as the content again. So that's a sore point with me. But going back to verse 16 in Genesis, of every tree of the garden thou mayest eat freely. Well, this verse, unfortunately, cannot be taken as a standalone verse, because 17, the next one, starts off with, but. Well, now, if this one says thou mayest eat freely, how can you come along and say it's conditional on the but, which is in the next one? So logically, I'm not saying there's something wrong here. I'm just saying that we have to be careful again of how we separate these things, because it's the content, not the sequence again. So some of these things must be taken together. And the other thing that bugs the hell out of me, and I'm sorry to use that word, but I will, is that when Maimonides rewrote the Mishnah Torah, he had several things that bothered him. One of them was that came from the Sabaeans. And in the Torah, there's a specific thing that says you cannot eat the first fruit of a particular fruit tree.
Right.
Well, here it is saying the garden thou mayest freely eat. Well, this sounds like a little condition or a restriction somewhere. Now, the reason why Maimonides went over this is because he said this was the Sabaeans, that they were doing this. So therefore, they said, they put this in the Torah so that you could differentiate between real lovers of God and Sabaeans. So therefore, it was put in there specifically to condition people to stay away from, so you couldn't continue the Sabaean type of mentality or paganism that was going on at the time. There, I got it out, John.
Beautiful. Well, Dennis, but my point was is that if people want us to go further into it, they got to tune into next week's show, where we'll go into chapter 2, verse 17 of Genesis. So, you know, that's the way Torah is, you know. Sometimes it gives you an instruction, and it leaves you hanging. So we're going to, unfortunately, have to leave some all the blessed souls listening to us hanging, saying, wait a minute, we were told we could eat everything, but... So the only way I can respond is, but you'll just have to tune in next week, blessed souls, as we continue our dialogue in search of ancient authentic Torah number 47. Again, so thanks again to Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Goldstock from Heart to Heart Organization, hearttoheartamerican.org. Hopefully we'll do a live show this coming Tuesday, 9:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Dennis, thank you. I thank you profusely for braving these last almost 2 hours with me and Rabbi Goldstock, the Abbot Costello of the Soul, as we're known now as. And hopefully next week we'll reconnect, Dennis.
Okay, Don. And if you don't chime in next week, keep the faith and belief.
Amen. So we're going to end up, blessed souls, just reminding everyone, remember, don't overestimate the negativities or the lackings within yourself, and don't underestimate the good within yourself. We're going to end up with Ari Goldwag's song. He lives out in Beit Shemesh in Israel. Finally hear a song which I think is going to gradually, if not already, become the sign-off song, because the song is so authentic in terms of its sincerity, in terms of if we really want the Messiah, the Mashiach, the Anointed One, to come and lead the whole human family experience, we have to check out where our present state of consciousness is. In the meantime, Ahav Echad, one love, Goyel Echad, one destiny, Kulanu for all of us, Baruch Shalom, in a way of peace, Darki Nom, in a way of pleasantness, Be'ezer Hashem Yisrael, with the help of the Most High, Lahamshik, to be continued. Take care, everyone. Joy filled.
man? Did you hear it? The chauffeur? Or am I going mad?